This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Mothers by Britt Bennett. Read for you by Adenrale Ojo. Chapter 1. We didn't believe when we first heard, because you know how church folk can gossip. Like the time we all thought First John, our head usher, was messing around on his wife because Betty, the pastor's secretary, caught him cozying up at brunch with another woman. A young, fashionable woman at that, one who switched her hips when she walked, even though she had no business switching anything in front of a man married 40 years. You could forgive a man for stepping out on his wife once, but to romance that young woman over buttered croissants at a sidewalk cafe? Now that was a whole other thing. But before we could correct First John, he showed up at Upper Room Chapel that Sunday with his wife and the young hip-switching woman, a great niece visiting from Fort Worth. And that was that. When we first heard, we thought it might be that type of secret, although we have to admit, it had felt different. Tasted different, too. All good secrets have a taste before you tell them, and if we'd taken a moment to swish this one around our mouths, we might have noticed the sourness of an unripe secret, plucked too soon, stolen and passed around before its season. But we didn't. We shared this sour secret, a secret that began the spring Nadia Turner got knocked up by the pastor's son and went to the abortion clinic downtown to take care of it. She was 17 then. She lived with her father, a Marine, and without her mother, who had killed herself 6 months earlier. Since then, the girl had earned a wild reputation. She was young and scared, and trying to hide her scared in her prettiness. And she was pretty, beautiful even, with amber skin, silky long hair, and eyes swirled brown and gray and gold. Like most girls, she'd already learned that pretty exposes you and pretty hides you, and like most girls, she hadn't yet learned how to navigate the difference. So we heard all about her sojourns across the border to dance clubs in Tijuana, the water bottle she carried around Oceanside High filled with vodka, the Saturdays she spent on base playing pool with Marines, nights that ended with her heels pressed against some man's foggy window. Just tales, maybe, except for one we now know is true. She spent her senior year of high school rolling around in bed with Luke Shepherd, and come springtime, his baby was growing inside her. Luke Shepherd waited tables at Fat Charlie's Seafood Shack, a restaurant off the pier known for its fresh food, live music, and family-friendly atmosphere. At least, that's what the ad in the San Diego Union-Tribune said, if you were fool enough to believe it. If you'd been around Oceanside long enough, you'd know that the promised fresh food was day-old fish and chips stewing under heat lamps, and the live music, when delivered, usually consisted of ragtag teenagers in ripped jeans with safety pins poking through their lips. Nadia Turner also knew things about Fat Charlie's that didn't fit on a newspaper ad, like the fact that a platter of Charlie's cheesy nachos was the perfect drunk snack, or that the head cook sold the best weed north of the border. She knew that inside, yellow life preservers hung above the bar, so after long shifts, the three black waiters called it a slave ship. She knew secret things about Fat Charlie's because Luke had told her.
"What about the fish sticks?" she would ask.
"Soggy as shit."
"The seafood pasta? Don't fuck with that.
What could be so bad about pasta? You know how they make that shit? Take some fish that's been sitting around and stuff it in ravioli.
Fine, the bread then.
If you don't finish your bread, we just give it to another table. You about to touch the same bread as some dude that's been digging in his nuts all day.
The winter her mother killed herself, Luke saved Nadia from ordering the crab bites. Imitation crab deep fried in lard. She'd begun disappearing after school, riding buses and hopping off wherever they took her. Sometimes she rode east to Camp Pendleton, where she watched a movie or bowled at Stars and Strikes or played pool with Marines. The young ones were the loneliest, so she always found a pack of privates, awkward with their shorn heads and big boots, and by the end of the night, she usually ended up kissing one of them until kissing made her feel like crying. Other days, she rode north, past Upper Room Chapel, where the coast became frontier. South, and she hit more beach, better beaches, beaches with sand as white as the people who lay on it, beaches with boardwalks and roller coasters, beaches behind gates. She couldn't ride west. West was the ocean. She rode buses away from her old life, where after school she'd lingered with her friends in the parking lot before driver's ed, or climbed the bleachers to watch the football team practice, or caravaned to In-N-Out. She'd goofed around at JoJo's Juicery with her coworkers, and danced at bonfires, and climbed the jetty when dared because she always pretended to be unafraid. She was startled by how rarely she had been alone back then. Her days felt like being handed from person to person like a baton. Her calculus teacher passing her to her Spanish teacher, to her chemistry teacher, to her friends, and back home to her parents. Then one day, her mother's hand was gone, and she'd fallen, clattering to the floor. She couldn't stand to be around anyone now. Her teachers who excused her late work with patient smiles, her friends who stopped joking when she sat down at lunch, as if their happiness were offensive to her. In AP government, when Mr. Thomas assigned partner work, her friends quickly paired off with each other, and she was left to work with the other quiet, friendless girl in the class, Aubrey Evans, who skirted off to Christian club meetings at lunch, not to pad her college resume. She hadn't raised her hand when Mr. Thomas asked who had turned in applications, but because she thought God cared if she spent her free period inside a classroom planning canned food drives. Aubrey Evans, who wore a plain gold purity ring that she twisted around her finger when she talked, who always attended service at Upper Room by herself, probably the poor holy child of devout atheists, who was working hard to lead them into the light. After their first time working together, Aubrey had leaned closer to her, dropping her voice.
"I just wanted to say I'm sorry," she said. "We've all been praying for you."
She seemed sincere, but what did that matter? Nadia hadn't been to church since her mother's funeral. Instead, she rode buses. One afternoon, she climbed off downtown in front of the Hanky Panky. She was certain someone would stop her. She even looked like a kid with her backpack. But the bouncer perched on a stool near the door barely glanced up from his phone when she ducked inside. At 3 on a Tuesday, the strip club was dead, empty silver tables dulled under the stage lights. Black shades pulled in front of the windows blocked the plastic sunlight. In the man-made darkness, fat white men with baseball caps pulled low, slouched in chairs facing the stage. Under the spotlight, a flabby white girl danced, her breasts swinging like pendulums. In the darkness of the club, you could be alone with your grief. Her father had flung himself into Upper Room. He went to both services on Sunday mornings, to Wednesday night Bible study, to Thursday night choir practice, although he did not sing, although practices were closed, but nobody had the heart to turn him away. Her father propped his sadness on a pew, but she put her sad in places no one could see. The bartender shrugged at her fake ID and mixed her a drink, and she sat in dark corners, sipping rum and cokes and watching women with beat bodies spin on stage. Never the skinny young girls. The club saved them for weekends or nights. Just older women thinking about grocery lists and childcare. Their bodies stretched and pitted from age. Her mother would have been horrified at the thought. Her in a strip club in the light of day. But Nadia stayed, sipping the watery drinks slowly. Her third time in the club, an old black man pulled up a chair beside her. He wore a red plaid shirt under suspenders, gray tufts peeking out from under his Pacific Coast bait and tackle cap.
"What you drinking?"
he asked. "What are you drinking?" she said. He laughed.
"Nah, this a grown man drink. Not for a little thing like you. I'll get you something sweet. You like that, honey? You look like you got a sweet tooth."
He smiled and slid a hand onto her thigh. His fingernails curled dark and long against her jeans. Before she could move, a black woman in her 40s wearing a glittery magenta bra and thong appeared at the table. Light brown streaked across her stomach like tiger stripes.
"You leave her be, Lester," the woman said. Then to Nadia, "Come on, I'll freshen you up."
"Oh, Cece, I was just talking to her," the old man said.
"Please," Cece said. "That child ain't even as old as your watch."
She led Nadia back to the bar and tossed what was left of her drink down the drain. Then she slipped into a white coat and beckoned for Nadia to follow her outside. Against the slate gray sky, the flat outline of the hanky-panky seemed even more depressing. Further along the building, two white girls were smoking, and they each threw up a hand when Cece and Nadia stepped outside. Cece returned the lazy greeting and lit a cigarette.
"You got a nice face," Cece said. "Those your real eyes? You mixed?"
"No," she said. "I mean, they're my eyes, but I'm not mixed."
"Look mixed to me."
Cece blew a sideways stream of smoke.
"You a runaway? Oh, don't look at me like that. I won't report you. I see you girls come through here all the time, looking to make a little money. Ain't legal, but Bernie don't mind. Bernie'll give you a little stage time, see what you can do. Don't expect no warm welcome, though. Hard enough fighting those blonde bitches for tips. Wait till the girls see your light bright ass."
"I don't want to dance," Nadia said.
"Well, I don't know what you're looking for, but you ain't gonna find it here."
Cece leaned in closer.
"You know you got see-through eyes. Feels like I can see right through them. Nothing but sad on the other side."
She dug into her pocket and pulled out a handful of crumpled ones.
"This ain't no place for you. Go on down to Fat Charlie's and get you something to eat. Go on."
Nadia hesitated, but Cece dropped the bills into Nadia's palm and curled her fingers into a fist. Maybe she could do this, pretend she was a runaway, or maybe in a way, she was. Her father never asked where she'd been. She returned home at night and found him in his recliner, watching television in a darkened living room. He always looked surprised when she unlocked the front door, like he hadn't even noticed that she'd been gone. In Fat Charlie's, Nadia had been sitting in a booth toward the back, flipping through a menu. When Luke Shepherd stepped out of the kitchen, white apron slung across his hips, black Fat Charlie's t-shirt stretched across his muscular chest. He looked as handsome as she'd remembered from Sunday school, except he was a man now, bronzed and broad-shouldered, his hard jaw covered in stubble. And he was limping now, slightly favoring his left leg, but the gimpiness of his walk, its uneven pace and tenderness, only made her want him more. Her mother had died a month ago, and she was drawn to anyone who wore their pain outwardly, the way she couldn't. She hadn't even cried at the funeral. At the repast, a parade of guests had told her how well she'd done, and her father placed an arm around her shoulder. He'd hunched over the pew during the service, his shoulders quietly shaking, manly crying, but crying still. And for the first time, she'd wondered if she might be stronger than him. An inside hurt was supposed to stay inside. How strange it must be to hurt in an outside way you couldn't hide. She played with the menu flap as Luke limped his way over to her booth. She and everyone at Upper Room had watched his promising sophomore season end last year. A routine kick return, a bad tackle, and his leg broke, the bone cutting clear through the skin. The commentators had said he'd be lucky if he walked normal again, let alone played another down, so no one had been surprised when San Diego State pulled his scholarship. But she hadn't seen Luke since he'd gotten out of the hospital. In her mind, he was still in a cot, surrounded by doting nurses, his bandaged leg propped toward the ceiling. "What are you doing here?" she asked.
"I work here," he said,
then laughed, but his laugh sounded hard, like a chair suddenly scraped against the floor.
"How you been?"
He didn't look at her, shuffling through his notepad, so she knew he'd heard about her mother.
"I'm hungry," she said.
"That's how you been? Hungry?
Can I get the crab bites?"
"You better not."
He guided her finger down the laminated menu to the nachos.
"There, try that."
His hand curved soft over hers, like he was teaching her to read, moving her finger under unfamiliar words. He always made her feel impossibly young, like 2 days later when she returned to his section and tried to order a margarita. He laughed, tilting her fake ID toward him.
"Come on," he said. "Aren't you like 12?
She narrowed her eyes. "Oh, fuck you," she said. "I'm 17. But she'd said it a little too proudly, and Luke laughed again. Even 18, which she wouldn't turn until late August, would seem young to him. She was still in high school. He was 21 and had already gone to college, a real university, not the community college where everyone loafed around a few months after graduation before finding jobs. She had applied to 5 universities, and while she waited to hear back, she asked Luke questions about college life, like were dorm showers as gross as she imagined, and did people actually stick socks on door handles when they wanted privacy? He told her about undie runs and foam parties, how to maximize your meal plan, how to get extra time on tests by pretending you had a learning problem. He knew things, and he knew girls, college girls, girls who wore high heels to class, not sneakers, and carried satchels instead of backpacks, and spent their summers interning at Qualcomm or California Bank and Trust, not making juice at the pier. She imagined herself in college, one of those sophisticated girls, Luke driving to see her, or if she went out of state, flying to visit her over spring break. He would laugh if he knew how she imagined him in her life. He teased her often, like when she began doing her homework in Fat Charlie's.
"Shit," he said, flipping through her calculus book. "You a nerd."
She wasn't, really, but learning came easily to her. Her mother used to tease her about that. "Must be nice," she'd say. When Nadia brought home an aced test she only studied for the night before. She thought her advanced classes might scare Luke off, but he liked that she was smart. "See this girl right here?" he'd tell a passing waiter. "First black lady president. Just watch." Every black girl who was even slightly gifted was told this. But she liked listening to Luke brag, and she liked it even more when he teased her for studying. He didn't treat her like everyone at school, who either sidestepped her or spoke to her like she was some fragile thing, one harsh word away from breaking. One February night, Luke drove her home, and she invited him inside. Her father was gone for the weekend at the men's advance, so the house was dark and silent when they arrived. She wanted to offer Luke a drink. That's what women did in the movies. Handed a man a boxy glass, filled with something dark and masculine. But moonlight glinted off glass cabinets emptied of liquor, and Luke pressed her against the wall and kissed her. She hadn't told him it was her first time, but he knew. In her bed, he asked three times if she wanted to stop. Each time she told him no. Sex would hurt, and she wanted it to. She wanted Luke to be her outside hurt. By spring, she knew what time Luke got off work, when to meet him in the deserted corner of the parking lot, where two people could be alone. She knew which nights he had off, nights she listened for his car crawling up her street and tiptoed past her father's shut bedroom. She knew the days he went to work late, days she slipped him inside the house before her father came home from work. How Luke wore his Fat Charlie's t-shirt, a size too small, because it helped him earn more tips. How when he dropped to the edge of her bed without saying much, he was dreading a long shift, so she didn't say much either, tugging his too tight shirt over his head and running her hands over the expanse of his shoulders. She knew that being on his feet all day hurt his leg more than he ever admitted, and sometimes, while he slept, she stared at the thin scar climbing toward his knee. Bones, like anything else, strong until they weren't. She also knew that Fat Charlie's was dead between lunch and happy hour. So after her pregnancy tests returned positive, she rode the bus over to tell Luke.
"Fuck,"
was the first thing he said. Then,
"Are you sure?"
Then,
"But are you sure, sure?"
Then,
"Fuck."
In the empty Fat Charlie's, Nadia drowned her fries in a pool of ketchup until they were limp and soggy. Of course she was sure. She wouldn't have worried him if she weren't already sure. For days, she'd willed herself to bleed, begging for a drop, a trickle even. But instead, she only saw the perfect whiteness of her panties. So that morning, she rode the bus to the free pregnancy center outside of town, a squat gray building in the middle of a strip mall. In the lobby, a row of fake plants nearly blocked the receptionist, who pointed Nadia to the waiting area. She joined a handful of black girls who barely glanced up at her as she sat between a chubby girl popping purple gum and a girl in overall shorts who played Tetris on her phone. A fat white counselor named Dolores led Nadia to the back, where they squeezed inside a cubicle so cramped their knees touched.
"Now,"
Do you have a reason to think you might be pregnant?
Dolores asked. She wore a lumpy gray sweater covered in cotton sheep and spoke like a kindergarten teacher, smiling, her sentences ending in a gentle lilt. She must have thought Nadia was an idiot, another black girl too dumb to insist on a condom. But they had used condoms, at least most times, and Nadia felt stupid for how comfortable she had felt with their mostly safe sex. She was supposed to be the smart one. She was supposed to understand that it only took one mistake and her future could be ripped away from her. She had known pregnant girls. She had seen them waddling around school in tight tank tops and sweatshirts that hugged their bellies. She never saw the boys who had gotten them that way. Their names were enshrouded in mystery, as wispy as rumor itself. But she could never unsee the girls, big and blooming in front of her. Of all people, she should have known better. She was her mother's mistake. Across the booth, Luke hunched over the table, flexing his fingers like he used to when he was on the sidelines at a game. Her freshman year, she'd spent more time watching Luke than watching the team on the field. What would those hands feel like touching her?
I thought you were hungry, he said.
She tossed another fry onto the pile. She hadn't eaten anything all day. Her mouth felt salty, the way it did before she puked. She slipped out of her flip-flops, resting her bare feet against his thigh.
I feel like shit, she said.
Want something different?
I don't know.
He pushed away from the table.
Let me get you something else.
I can't keep it, she said.
Luke stopped, halfway out of his seat.
What?
He said.
I can't keep a baby,
she said.
I can't be someone's fucking mother. I'm going to college, and my dad is gonna...
She couldn't bring herself to say out loud what she wanted. The word abortion felt ugly and mechanical. But Luke understood, didn't he? He'd been the first person she told when she received her acceptance email from the University of Michigan. He'd swept her into a hug before she even finished her sentence, nearly crushing her in his arms. He had to understand that she couldn't pass this up, her one chance to leave home, to leave her silent father, whose smile hadn't even reached his eyes when she showed him the email, but who she knew would be happier with her gone, without her there to remind him of what he'd lost. She couldn't let this baby nail her life in place when she'd just been given a chance to escape. If Luke understood, he didn't say so. He didn't say anything at first, sinking back into the booth, his body suddenly slow and heavy. In that moment, he looked even older to her, his stubbled face tired and haggard. He reached for her bare feet and cradled them in his lap.
Okay,
he said, then softer.
Okay, tell me what to do.
He didn't try to change her mind. She appreciated that, although part of her had hoped he might do something old-fashioned and romantic, like offer to marry her. She never would have agreed, but it would have been nice if he'd tried. Instead, he asked how much money she needed. She felt stupid. She hadn't even thought of something as practical as paying for the surgery. But he promised he'd come up with the cash. When he handed her the envelope the next day, she asked him not to wait with her at the clinic. He rubbed the back of her neck.
Are you sure?
He said.
Yes, she said. Just pick me up after.
She'd feel worse if she had an audience. Vulnerable. Luke had seen her naked. He had slipped inside her own body. But somehow, his seeing her afraid was an intimacy she could not bear. The morning of her appointment, Nadia rode the bus to the abortion clinic downtown. She had driven past it dozens of times, an unremarkable tan building slunk in the shadows of a Bank of America, but she had never imagined what it might look like inside. As the bus wound its way toward the beach, she stared out the window, envisioning sterile white walls, sharp tools on trays, fat receptionists in baggy sweaters herding crying girls into waiting rooms. Instead, the lobby was open and bright. The walls painted a creamy color that had some fancy name like taupe or ochre, and on the oak tables, beside stacks of magazines, there were blue vases filled with seashells. In a chair farthest from the door, Nadia pretended to read a National Geographic. Next to her, a redhead mumbled as she struggled with a crossword puzzle. Her boyfriend slumped beside her, staring at the dark insides of his sunglasses. He was the only man in the room, so maybe the redhead felt superior, more loved, since her boyfriend had joined her, even though he didn't seem like a good boyfriend, even though he wasn't even talking to her or holding her hand like Luke would have done. Across the room, a black girl in a clingy yellow dress sniffled into her jean jacket sleeve. Her mother, a heavy woman with a purple rose tattooed on her arm, sat beside her, arms folded across her chest. She looked angry, or maybe just worried. The girl looked 14, broad-shouldered like a swimmer, and the louder she sniffled, the harder everyone tried not to look at her. Nadia thought about texting Luke. I'm here. I'm okay. But he'd just started his shift, and he was probably worried enough as it was. She flipped through the magazine slowly, her eyes gliding off the pages to the blonde receptionist smiling into her headset, the traffic outside, the blue vase of seashells beside her. Her mother had hated the actual beach. Messy sand and cigarette butts everywhere. But she loved shells, so whenever they went, she always spent the afternoon padding along the shore, bending to peel shells out of the damp sand. They call me, she'd said once. She'd clutched Nadia on her lap and turned a shell carefully, flashing its shiny insides. In her hand, the shell had glimmered lavender and green.
Turner?
In the doorway, a black nurse with graying dreadlocks read her name off a metal clipboard. As Nadia gathered her purse, she felt the nurse give her a once-over, eyes drifting past her red blouse, skinny jeans, black pumps.
Should have worn something more comfortable, the nurse said.
I am comfortable. Nadia said. She felt 13 again, standing in the vice principal's office as he lectured her on the dress code.
Sweatpants, the nurse said. Someone should have told you that when you called.
They did.
The nurse shook her head, starting back down the hall. She seemed weary, unlike the chipper white nurses squeaking down the hallways in pink scrubs and rubber shoes. Like she'd seen so much that nothing surprised her anymore. Not even a girl with a sassy mouth wearing a silly outfit, a girl so alone she couldn't find one person to sit with her in the waiting room. No, there was nothing special about a girl like this. Not her good grades, not her prettiness. She was just another black girl who'd found herself in trouble,
and was finding her way out of it. In the sonogram room, a technician asked Nadia if she wanted to see the screen. Optional, he said, but it gave some women closure. She told him no. She'd heard once about a 16-year-old girl from her high school who'd given birth and left her baby on the beach. The girl was arrested when she doubled back to tell a cop she'd seen a baby and he discovered that she was the mother. How could he tell? Nadia had always wondered. Maybe, in the floodlights of his patrol car, he'd spotted blood streaking the insides of her thighs or smelled fresh milk spotting her nipples. Or maybe it was something else entirely. The ginger way she'd handed the baby over, the carefulness in her eyes when he brushed sand off its downy hair. Maybe he saw, even as he backed away, the maternal love that stretched like a golden thread from her to the abandoned baby. Something had given the girl away, but Nadia wouldn't make the same mistake. Double back. She wouldn't hesitate and allow herself to love the baby or even know him. Just do it already, she said.
What about multiples? The technician asked, rolling toward her on his stool. You know, twins, triplets.
Why would I want to know that? He shrugged.
Some women do.
She already knew too much about the baby, like the fact that it was a boy. It was too early to actually tell, but she felt his foreignness in her body, something that was her and wasn't her. A male presence, a boy child who would have Luke's thick curls and squinty-eyed smile. No, she couldn't think about that either. She couldn't allow herself to love the baby because of Luke. So when the technician swirled the sensor in the blue goo on her stomach, she turned her head away. After a few moments, the technician stopped, pausing the sensor over her belly button.
Huh,
he said.
What?
She said.
What happened?
Maybe she wasn't actually pregnant. That could happen, couldn't it? Maybe the test had been wrong, or maybe the baby had sensed he wasn't wanted. Maybe he had given up on his own. She couldn't help it. She turned toward the monitor. The screen filled with a wedge of grainy white light, and in the center, a black oval punctuated by a single white splotch.
Your womb's a perfect sphere, the technician said.
So, what does that mean?
I don't know, he said. That you're a superhero, maybe.
He chuckled, swirling the sensor around the gel. She didn't know what she expected to see in the sonogram. The sloping of a forehead, maybe? The outline of a belly? Not this. White and bean-shaped and small enough to cover with her thumb. How could this tiny light be a life? How could something this small bring hers to an end? When she returned to the waiting room, the girl in the yellow dress was sobbing. No one looked at her, not even the heavy woman who was now sitting one seat over. Nadia had been wrong. This woman couldn't be the girl's mother. A mother would move toward a crying child, not away. Her mother would have held her and absorbed her tears into her own body. She would have rocked her and not let go until the nurse called her name again. But this woman reached over and pinched the crying girl's thigh.
Cut all that out, she said. You wanted to be grown? Well, now you grown.
The procedure only takes 10 minutes, the dreadlocked nurse told her. Less than an episode of television. In the chilly operating room, Nadia stared at the monitor that hung in front of her, flashing pictures from beaches around the world. Overhead, speakers played a meditation CD, classical guitar over crashing waves. and she knew she was supposed to pretend she was lying on a tropical island, pressed against grains of white sand. But when the nurse fit the anesthesia mask on her face and told her to count to 100, she could only think about the girl abandoning her baby in the sand. Maybe the beach was a more natural place to leave a baby you couldn't care for. Nestle him in the sand and hope someone found him. An old couple on a midnight stroll. A patrol cop sweeping his flashlight over beer cases. But if they didn't, if no one stumbled upon him, he'd return to his first home, an ocean like the one inside of her. Water would break onto the shore, sweep him up in its arms, and rock him back to sleep. When it was over, Luke never came for her. An hour after she'd called him, she was the only girl still waiting in the recovery room, curled in an overstuffed pink recliner, clutching a heat pad against her cramping stomach. For an hour, she'd stared into the dimness of the room, unable to make out the faces of the others, but imagining they looked as blank as hers. Maybe the girl in the yellow dress had cried into the arms of her recliner. Or maybe the redhead had just continued her crossword puzzle. Maybe she'd been through this before, or she already had children and couldn't take another. Was it easier if you already had a child, like politely declining seconds because you were already full? Now the others were gone, and she had pulled out her phone to call Luke a third time when the dreadlocked nurse dragged over a metal chair. She was carrying a paper plate of crackers and an apple juice box.
"Cramps'll be bad for a while," she said. "Just put some heat on 'em and they'll go away. You got a heat pad at home?"
"No."
"Just heat you up a towel. Works just as fine."
Nadia had hoped she might get a different nurse. She'd watched the others swish through the room to dote on their girls, offering smiles, squeezing hands. But the dreadlocked nurse just shook the plate at her.
"I'm not hungry," Nadia said.
"You need to eat. Can't let you go until you do."
Nadia sighed, taking a cracker. Where was Luke? She was tired of this nurse with her wrinkled skin and steady eyes. She wanted to be in her own bed, wrapped in her comforter, her head on Luke's chest. He would make her soup and play movies on his laptop until she fell asleep. He would kiss her and tell her that she had been brave. The nurse uncrossed, then recrossed her legs.
"Heard from your friend yet?" she asked.
"Not yet, but he's coming," Nadia said.
"You got someone else to call?"
"I don't need someone else. He's coming."
"He's not coming, baby," the nurse said. "Do you have someone else to call?"
Nadia glanced up, startled by the nurse's confidence that Luke would not show, but even more jolted by her use of the word baby, a cotton-soft baby that seemed to surprise the nurse herself, like it had tripped off her tongue. Just like how after the surgery, in her delirium, Nadia had looked into the nurse's blurred face and said,
"Mommy?"
With such sweetness, the nurse had almost answered yes. Chapter 2.
If Nadia Turner had asked, we would have warned her to stay away from him. You know what they say about pastor's kids. In Sunday school, they're running around the sanctuary, hollering, smearing crayons on the pews. In middle school, a pastor's son chases girls, flipping up their dresses, while his sister smears on bright lipstick that makes her look like a harlot. By high school, the son is smoking reefer in the church parking lot,
and the daughter is being felt up in a bathroom stall by the deacon's son, who is quietly unrolling the pantyhose her mother insisted she wear because ladies don't show their bare legs in church. Luke Shepherd, bold and brash with wispy curls, football-built shoulders, and that squinty-eyed smile. Oh, any of us could have told her to stay away from him. She wouldn't have listened, of course. What did the church mothers know anyway? Not how Luke held her hand while they slept or played with her hair when they cuddled, or how after she'd told him about the pregnancy test, he cradled her bare feet in his lap. A man who laced his fingers through yours all night and held your feet when you were sad had to love you, at least a little bit. Besides, what did a bunch of old ladies know? We would have told her that all together, we got centuries on her. If we laid all our lives toes to heel, we were born before the Depression, the Civil War, even America itself. And all that living, we have known men. Oh, girl, we have known little bit love. That little bit of honey left in an empty jar that traps the sweetness in your mouth long enough to mask your hunger. We have run tongues over teeth to savor that last little bit as long as we could. And in all our living, nothing has starved us more. 10 years before Nadia Turner's appointment, we'd already made our first visit to the abortion clinic downtown. Oh, not the way you're thinking. By the time that clinic was built, we would have laughed like Sarah at the thought of having babies, unwanted or otherwise. Besides, we were already mothers then, some by heart and some by womb. We rocked grandbabies left in our care and taught the neighborhood kids piano and baked pies for the sick and shut-in. We all mothered somebody, and more than that, we all mothered Upper Room Chapel. So when the church started a protest out front, we joined too. Not like Upper Room was the type of church to fuss at every little thing it didn't like, shake fists at rated R movies, or buy armloads of rap CDs just to crush them, or write letters to Sacramento to ensure the state's list of banned books stayed long and current. In fact, the church had only protested once before, back in the 70s, when Oceanside's first strip club was built. A strip club minutes from the beach where children swam and played. What next? A brothel on the pier? Why not turn the harbor into a red light district? Well, the hanky-panky opened, and even though it was a blight to the community, everyone agreed that the new abortion clinic was much worse. A sign of the times, really. An abortion clinic going up downtown just as easy as a donut shop. So the morning of the protest, the congregation gathered in front of the unbuilt clinic. Second John, who had driven the carless in the church van, and Sister Willis, who had instructed her Sunday school students to help color in the protest signs, and even Magdalena Price, who could hardly be bothered to do anything around Upper Room that required her to step out from behind her piano bench, had come down to the protest to, as she put it, see what all the fuss was about. All of us had circled around the pastor and the first lady and their son, a boy then, kicking dirt clods onto the sidewalk, while the pastor prayed for the souls of innocents. Our protest only lasted 3 days, Not because of our wavering convictions, but because of the militants who joined us. The type of crazed white people who would end up on the news someday for bombing clinics or stabbing doctors. The last place any of us wanted to be was near the scene when one went off the deep end. All 3 days, Robert Turner drove downtown at 6 a.m. to deliver a new batch of picket signs from the church. He and his wife were not the protesting type, he told the pastor, but he'd figured that transporting the signs was the least he could do, truck and all. This was 10 years before he would be known around Upper Room as the man with the truck, a black Chevy pickup that had become Upper Room's truck because of how often Robert was seen driving from church, an arm hanging out the window, the truck bed filled with food baskets or donated clothes or metal chairs. He wasn't the only member with the truck, of course, but he was the only one willing to lend his at any moment. He kept a calendar by the phone, and whenever anyone from Upper Room called, he carefully scheduled them in with a tiny golf pencil. Sometimes he joked that he should add the truck to his answering machine greeting because the truck would earn more messages than he did anyway. A joke, although he wondered if it was true. If the truck was the only reason he was invited to picnics and potlucks, if the true guest was the truck, needed to haul speakers and tables and folding chairs, but no one minded if he tagged along too. Why else would he receive such warm greetings when he stepped into Upper Room each Sunday? The ushers clapping his back and the ladies at the welcome table smiling at him and the pastor mentioning once, in passing, that he wouldn't be shocked if Robert's good stewardship landed him on the elders' board one day. The truck, Robert believed, had turned things around for him. But there was also his daughter. People are always tender-hearted toward single fathers, especially single fathers raising girls, and folks would have cared for Robert Turner still, even if that terrible thing hadn't happened with his wife, even if she had just packed a suitcase and left, which to some, it seemed like she did anyway. That evening, when her father pulled his truck into the garage, Nadia was curled in bed, clutching her twisting stomach. The cramps might be bad, the dreadlocked nurse had told her. Expect them a few hours or so. Call the emergency number if they're severe. The nurse didn't explain the difference between bad cramps and severe ones, but she'd handed Nadia a white bag curled at the top like a sack lunch. For the pain, 2 every 4 hours. A clinic volunteer offered to drive Nadia home, and when she climbed into the white girl's dusty Sentra, she glanced out the window at the nurse, who watched them drive off. The volunteer, blonde, 20-ish, earnest, chatted nervously the whole drive, fiddling with the radio dials. She was a junior at Cal State San Marcos, she said, volunteering at the clinic as part of her feminist studies major. She looked like the type of girl who could go to college, major in something like feminist studies, and still expect to be taken seriously. She asked if Nadia planned to go to college and seemed surprised by her response.
Oh, Michigan's a good school, she said, as if Nadia didn't already know this.
That was 2 hours ago. Nadia clenched her eyes, passing through the cold center of the pain into its warmer edges. She wanted to take another pill, even though she knew she should wait. But when she heard the garage door rumble, she shoved the orange vial into the white bag, everything inside her nightstand drawer. Anything unusual might tip her father off, even that nondescript bag. Since she discovered that she was pregnant,
She'd been sure that her father would notice something was wrong with her. Her mother had been able to tell when she'd had a bad day at school, moments after she'd climbed into the car. "What happened?" her mother used to ask, even before Nadia had said hello. Her father had never been that perceptive, but a pregnancy wasn't a bad day at school. He would notice that she was panicking. He would have to. She was grateful so far that he hadn't, but it scared her. How you could return home in a different body, how something big could be happening inside you, and no one even knew it. Her father knocked 3 times and nudged her bedroom door open. He wore his service khakis today, which seemed like a second skin, how naturally he fit within sharp pleats, a row of badges across his chest. Her friends used to be surprised that her father was a Marine. He didn't seem like the boys they'd grown up seeing around town, cocky and buff and horsing around in front of the Regal, flirting with passing girls. Maybe her father had been like that when he was younger, but she couldn't imagine it. He was quiet and intense, a tall, wiry man who never seemed to relax, like a guard dog on his haunches, his ears always perked up. He leaned in her doorway, bending to unlace his shiny black boots.
"You don't look so good," he said. "You sick?"
"Just cramps," she said. "Oh, you're..." He gestured to his stomach.
"Need anything?"
"No," she said. "Wait, can I use your truck later?"
"For what?"
"To drive?"
"Where are you going, I mean?"
"You can't do that."
"Do what?"
"Ask where I'm going. I'm almost 18.
"I can't ask where you're taking my truck."
"Where do you think I'm taking it?" she said. "The border?" Her father never cared about where she went, except when she asked to borrow his precious truck. He spent evenings circling the truck in the driveway, dipping a red velvet square into a tub of wax until the paint shone like glass. Then as soon as someone from upper room called for a favor, he jogged out the door, always running to his truck as if it were the only child, needy and demanding of his love. Her father sighed, running a hand over the graying hair she cut every 2 weeks, the way her mother used to, her father sitting in the backyard with a towel draped around his neck, her hands guiding the clippers. Cutting his hair was the only time she felt close to him. "Downtown, okay?" she said. "Can I borrow your truck, please?" Another wave of cramps gripped her, and she flinched, pulling her blanket tighter around herself. Her father lingered in the doorway a moment before dropping his keys on her dresser.
"I can make you some tea," he said. "It's supposed to. Your aunts, they'd drink it, you know, when..."
"You can just leave the keys," she said. The day after she was accepted into Michigan, Luke brought Nadia to the Wave Water Park, where they rode inner tubes down the slide tower and the flow rider until they were soaked and tired. At first, she'd worried that he'd suggested a water park because he thought she was childish. But he had as much fun as she did, yelping as they splashed into pools or dragging her to the next ride, water beads clinging to his chest, his wet sideburns glinting in the sun. After, they ate corn dogs and churros at the tables outside Rippity's Rainforest, where kids too small for the slides padded in floaties. She licked cinnamon sugar off her fingers, sun heavy and happy, the type of happiness that before might have felt ordinary, but now seemed fragile, like if she stood too quickly, it might slide off her shoulders and break. She hadn't expected a gift from Luke, not when her father had barely congratulated her. "Look at that," he'd said when she showed him the email, offering her a side hug. Then he'd passed her in the kitchen later that night, eyes glazing over her as if she were a once interesting piece of furniture he'd since tired of. She tried not to take it personally. He wasn't happy about anything these days, but she still teared up in the bathroom while brushing her teeth. The next morning, she awoke to a congratulations card on her nightstand with $20 folded inside. "I'm sorry," her father had written. "I'm trying." Trying what? Trying to love her? She stretched her legs across Luke's lap, and he kneaded the smooth skin near her ankles while he finished his corn dog. He'd never seen her like this before, hair wet and kinky, her face clean of makeup, but she felt pretty as he smiled at her across the table, touching her ankle, and she wondered if his gentle touch meant more, if he might even be in love with her a little bit. Before they left, she tried to take a picture of the two of them, but Luke cupped his hand around her phone. He wanted to keep their relationship a secret. "Not a secret," he said. "Just private."
"That's the same thing," she said.
"It's not. I just think we should be low-key about this, that's all."
"Why?"
"I mean, the age thing. I'm almost 18.
"Almost ain't 18.
"I wouldn't get you in trouble. Don't you know that?"
"It's not just that," he said.
"You don't know how it is. You're not a pastor's kid. The whole church in my business all the time, they'll be up in your business too. Let's just be smart, that's all I'm saying."
Maybe there was a difference. You hid a secret relationship out of shame, but you might keep a relationship private for any number of reasons. All relationships in some way were private. Why did anyone else need to know as long as you were happy? So she learned how to be private. She didn't reach for his hand in public or post photos of them online. She even stopped going to Fat Charlie's after school every day in case one of his coworkers began to wonder about them. But after Luke had left her at the abortion clinic, she forgot about being private and drove her father's truck to Fat Charlie's. She knew he closed on Thursday nights, but when she arrived, she didn't see him on the floor. At the bar, she waved down Pepe, a burly Mexican bartender with a graying ponytail. He glanced up from drying a glass with a brown rag.
"Go ahead and put that cheap-ass fake away," he said. "You know I ain't serving you."
"Where's Luke?" she asked.
"Hell if I know."
"Doesn't he get off soon?"
"I ain't in charge of his schedule."
"Well, have you seen him?"
"You okay?"
"Did you see him earlier? Why don't you just call him?" "He's not answering," she said. "I'm worried." It wasn't like Luke to disappear like this, to not answer his phone, to promise he'd be somewhere, then not show. Especially on a day like today when she needed him, when he knew she needed him. She was worried that something bad had happened to him, or even worse, that nothing had. What if he had abandoned her at that clinic because he'd simply chosen to? No, he would never do that. But she thought about him at the water park, clamping his hand over her phone, that brief moment when she had felt safe and loved right before Luke had pulled away. Pepe sighed, setting the glass on the bar. He had four daughters, Luke had told her once, and she wondered if this was why Pepe always refused her fake ID, always shooed away men who hit on her,
always asked her how she was getting home.
"Look, hon," he said, "you know Shepard. Probably just wanted to go out with his buddies. I'm sure he'll call you tomorrow. Just go home, won't you?"
In the end, she found Luke at a party. Not just any party, but a high school party, although Cody Richardson would have been offended to hear his parties referred to as such. He had graduated 10 years ago, after all, but his parties would always be high school parties because Nadia and everyone else at Oceanside High had spent countless weekends partying at his house. He was a sandy-haired skater, the type of white boy she had nothing in common with. But even though she normally hated white boy parties, the repetitive techno music, the smothering Abercrombie and Fitch cologne, the terrible dancing, she had gone to Cody Richardson's parties because everyone did. She had piled inside his beach bungalow every weekend, where you never worried about anyone's parents coming back to town early or the cops shutting the party down. And now his floor plan,